It's number 12, Lower Columbia River Sturgeon. This is a briefing and a public hearing. Cindy LaFleur and Brad James are here to brief us.
I'm Cindy LaFleur, Region 5 Fish Program Manager, and with me is Brad James, our sturgeon manager. And you've heard about sturgeon two other times, I believe, so this will be pretty short. Purpose is to follow up this briefing and public hearing for the Lower Columbia River Sturgeon with just reminding you where we are with the stock status, provide you with a little bit of new information, and some thoughts for 2015. And just as a reminder from your policy, the director is in discussions or will be in discussions with ODFW regarding options for fisheries in 2015. Will be, can be, something. So a review, population size, legal fish is has been increasing for 3 years, about 130,000, and the projection for this year is close to 140,000. And this graph just shows you what that trend is. So been increasing 3 years, basically. This is the new information, the sub-yearling production index. And we're showing it to you on two different graphs. The first graph is the one that the commission has seen year to year, and it's catch per set. And just notice the scale on this. It goes from less than one up to about six fish per set on the top. And then on the bottom, it's the proportion of positive sets. This bottom graph is one that Oregon staff uses to brief their commission. Didn't you show them? And you saw this graph last time, but what's new is a 2014 data point. But there's two different graphs. So the proportion of positive sets just means that a set was made and some fish were found. It was a positive. So looking at the 2014 number, it to me, it's very similar to the last 5 years. It's less than what we saw the previous 5 years or 6 years. That's all I have to say about that. Some considerations for 2015. Just kind of trying to summarize where we think we're at. We don't really have any indications that the legal size population abundance will increase significantly in the next decade. That's based on the set line data that you've been shown previously. So the fish recruiting into the legal size category. There's a little mountain, and it's you know, on the lower end. The sub-yearling production graph that we just looked at, it's, you know, for recent years, it's lower than previous years, but we really don't know how significant that is. But we do expect the spawner population, the very largest fish, to increase in a few years or maybe immediately, in a couple years. The spawner fish we do expect to increase, and that will continue to increase for some time, but it will take some time for those fish to produce offspring and for those offspring to recruit into the legal size category. And then a lot of this is based on our modeling, so there is uncertainty in our model. As all models, there's uncertainty. The most uncertainty is on the small end, the smallest size fish, which we have trouble catching. And on the large size end, and it's the very largest fish, and I think it's a matter of sample size as well. So the most confidence we have is in the legal size population estimate and the legal size abundance. It is difficult to predict into the future. However, this is the best model that we have available. And so today, that's all we have for you. Today was to really get some public testimony.
Okay.
Happy to answer questions.
Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know why I get stuck asking all the dumb questions, but I will ask some dumb questions here. How big are the fish are? How big are sturgeon when they start spawning? And where do they spawn? And what do you think the weak link is not getting recruitment?
So, Commissioner Holtzmiller, I'm Brad James. A female sturgeon will typically be larger than a male sturgeon when it's going to spawn. A 6-foot fish is likely to start first maturing. Males at a little bit smaller size. The second part of the question was,
where do they spawn?
And they seek out generally the fastest flowing areas of the river. So in the lower Columbia River, that's just downstream from Bonneville Dam, and also in the lower Willamette River, just downstream of Willamette Falls. Up in reservoir populations, they move up to the base of the upstream dam, where you have at least some water, water velocities of pretty decent, rate. If it's a low water year, production can be really poor, probably because it exposes the eggs in the larval stages to predation. If it's a high water year, the eggs and larvae then get dispersed over a much broader area, and we get better survival. As far as what we're currently seeing in the sub-yearling index, we suspect that the adult population has decreased in the recent past due primarily to predation from stellar sea lions. So there's a smaller adult population out there. It's not surprising to see poor index values of sub-yearlings.
So when he says adults, he means the spawner size fish.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Sturgeon? Okay. Thank you both. Now we'll hear from the public. We've got several people who've signed up. I think you all know the rules. 3 minutes, beeping noise, time is up. Bruce Cruikshanks, I still do not see in the room, so I'll put his aside. Kent Martin and Greg Johnson, would you come forward?
You ever do that?
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Commissioners, I'm Kent Martin, commercial fisherman from Skamaku, Washington. I guess I'm reacting to some comments that I have seen and heard from recreational fishing groups about sturgeon handle in the gillnet fishery, especially the oversized population and its relationship to spawner success. Firstly, I would note that the August-September gillnet fishery in zones 4 and 5 takes place after peak spawning in May and June and geographically below the spawning area near Bonneville. I would also like to interject a bit of history here. The concern with oversized broodstock population began in the era of Joe Blum, who promulgated a regulation prohibiting the removal of oversized sturgeon from the water to facilitate picture taking. The issue surfaced again with the appearance of oversized sturgeon carcasses with multiple, sometimes dozens of hooks in their guts. Much of this seems to have come from guided sturgeon trips that were and still are targeting oversized sturgeon as a catch-and-release trophy fishery. Quick check of the internet will confirm that guide services are currently booking trips for these, quote, hard-fighting dinosaur-like monster fish. About 3 years ago, our people suggested a good compromise, especially for the overside fishery, would be for the sport fishery to switch to circle hooks, something the North Pacific halibut fishery and the cod fisheries have been doing for decades. That unfortunately didn't get anywhere. I think that would be a problem if people want to target on oversize. You would at least not have those problems of sturgeon swallowing the hooks. My main concern is that this isn't a problem we created, and I don't think there's any scientific evidence that we are contributing to it significantly now. Believe me, as a commercial fisherman, the last thing I want to do is hassle with a 6, 7, 8 foot sturgeon. They're hard on my rain gear, hard on my back, and hard on my gear. Usually I have to cut them out. When they're that, you can't get them out of the water, or if you could get them out of the water or can, then you're faced with the problem of how do you get them back into the water. So anyway, I don't think it's our problem. It's unfortunate that it's there, but it is. So thank you.
Commissioner Smith has a question.
Thank you. And this is a broader question than you, sir. But I guess, are circle hooks being looked at? And if they aren't, why aren't they? So I just throw that out because I agree with you on the use of circle hooks, and I don't know why it wouldn't be something that we would look into.
There might be some people up there that have expertise on it. I know it was brought up and people talked about it, but I don't know that it ever went any farther than that.
Director Anderson, do you happen to know?
I am not aware of any discussion other than what Mr. Martin just shared about the potential of using circle hooks in the recreational fishery for sturgeon. I'm certainly aware of the use of circle hooks in the halibut fishery and the black cod fishery in particular, and they were also using them in the recreational salmon fishery in some places off California, but not aware of using circle hooks in sturgeon fisheries, but that doesn't mean it
isn't. I believe the state of Oregon in their set line fishery uses circle hooks. They went to long lines and got away from gill nets, not because there was a mortality problem with gill nets, but because in long lines they got a much broader perspective of sizes, you know, long ones, short ones, fat ones, tall ones, as opposed to a gill net, which selects pretty much for a specific size depending upon the mesh, size of gear.
Would Cindy know?
Yeah, Cindy, do you have any insight? Oh, Brett.
Butch. Brett. Yeah, well, Butch is going to testify pretty soon. We can ask him.
Thank you.
I don't want to get overly long in it. It seemed like a simple question that,
We did look at circle hooks in the sturgeon fishery a couple years ago, and we presented some information to the Fish Committee. Commissioner Schmitten was involved in that. Remember, we were going to go take that trip down to Florida or something to examine. Anyway.
That's a joke.
We did a literature review. Brad got some information from Idaho Fish and Game, who was using circle hooks, presented a bunch of information, at least to the Fish Committee, but I'm not sure where it ended. So,
maybe it's time to
take a look.
We can
visit.
Yeah, we can do that. Bring that back, and maybe Commissioner Mankin.
Commissioner Mankin.
I thought we were moving in that direction. I thought that we were going to do something about circle hook use.
Okay, now I do. Now I'm remembering. See the gray hair somewhere. We talked to Oregon about it. That was the next step. And at the time, so it's been, I would guess, about 2 years, they didn't want to talk about it. In fact, we did some test fishing with one of the Oregon staff members. Now, that was then, so maybe it's something that we bring back to them again.
Yep. Sounds like a good thing.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Robert Sudar, would you come forward?
I've misplaced my notes. Can you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Just take your time.
Hi, Greg Johnson again. I'm just going to bridge off of what Kent was alluding to, we're discussing. So this, and specifically this cortisol level, the issues in regards to that, and specific to a study that was done by the Oregon State University, Molly A. Webb was a one of the gatherers or writers of this. So I guess firstly, I'll just describe our fishery. We've drift for an average of this an hour and 15 minutes from point A to point B. In some instances, the net is tapping or on the ground, or on the bottom. In a lot of instances, it is not. It's up off the bottom. And so so interacting with a sturgeon would be in that time frame. Also, I've told you before that our fishery is seeing expanded numbers of fishers. And so as those new fishers have come in, the areas that are most productive, which are on the bottom, where you fish on the bottom, we clean the bottom and we're moving along the bottom, that's where the regular people fish, and some people are crowding into that. But a majority of the new people are fishing in the channel, the deeper water. They're not touching the bottom. Okay. The reason I make a point of that is because to interact with sturgeon, typically you have to be on the bottom. Or at slack tide, sometimes they'll rise to you. But in generally speaking, that's what has to occur. So anyway, the methods in this study weren't described very well in it. And so how they caught these fish in the study was they went up to Bonneville in above our fishery in the fast-moving water, like they refer to, where they like to spawn, and they used a 12-inch set net. And they set it out at like 8 p.m., and they didn't retrieve it till 1 p.m. in the morning. And when they first started this study, or when they first started taking these evaluations on these fish, they were leaving the water till 8 a.m. in the morning. So then they'd bring them on deck, and then they'd evaluate them for body scars and hooks and everything. You know, they'd taken multiple looks at these fish, and then they'd take their sample to try to get their cortisol levels. And so they'd have them on deck for 10 to 15 minutes. Then they would release them back into the water. So my only point is that I'm certainly not going to suggest that whether it's gill netting or sport fishing, that it's a therapeutic event for a sturgeon to be handled. But at the same time, this study and how they create these levels and everything, that's not a depiction of our fishery. We're not a set net. We're not anchored to the bottom. We're not, flows in zone 4 or 5 where this some of these constituent concerns have arisen. There's letters to the commission about constituent concerns. But anyway, so if I could, lastly, the only thing I'd like to that's it. Thank you.
No, you can finish.
Say it, Greg.
Well, I'm kind of forgetting. What it's Thank you.
Okay, Butch Smith.
Good afternoon, Commission. My name is Butch Smith. I'm a Waco Charter Association president. I'm a chairman of the Salmon Advisory Subpanel to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I'm a port commissioner, and I have a business charter office and motel in Elwaka, Washington. It's a family-owned business, one of the oldest ones. Charter services on the West Coast, continuously owned by the same family. I pretty much work for my wife, but... I do what she says, but I'm here today. I can go real quick into your question. What was proposed a couple years ago is a bait size limit and a hook restriction limit. Typically, you go up, if you're going to go oversized fishing, which I do not do, up by the dam in the your spawning area, you'll use a 2 or 3 pound shad with a 10 to 14 aught hook. We have been for on the record since about 1985, 86, 87, asking for that practice to be curtailed. I don't think you would take a 9-month pregnant woman out of the hospital bed, run her up and down for a 2 or 3 mile sprint, and then ask and think that everything would be hunky dory when she got back to the hospital. Nor do I think that's too good for sturgeon. So that's. We might have to revisit adding to that maybe bait size restriction and hook size restriction, and maybe broaden that sanctuary downriver farther. In the estuary where I fish, I'm like Kent. We do not like to see oversized. I mean, we like to see them because, but it really screws up the operation. And down there, typically a 5-inch bait with a 4 to 6-aught hook is the biggest. 99.9% are hooked right in the lip. So anyway, that kind of clears that up. That issue is up by the dam and not in the mid-river or down in the estuary where a lot of us fish. Coming from a coastal community, rural area, dependent on all fishing, I passed a picture out to you guys in December on what Memorial Saturday looked like 2014 without sturgeon, and it was a pretty sad situation. By staff and all the appearance, we have sufficient keeper size range to have some kind of limited harvest. We're not asking for the full 13.5 harvest rate, which says in the Oregon plan, but we're asking for something less so we can keep anglers engaged in this fisheries. It's obviously catch and release is not going anywhere. We knew that. We've had plenty of months in the bright sunshine where we closed for retention that people didn't participate in a catch and release in years past. So we're asking this commission, actually my area is begging this commission to consider some kind of reasonable harvest that takes in conservation in account. We're all for conservation to be prosecuted in, you know, May and June of this summer. And that's what we're asking for.
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Terry Turner, come forward.
I'm Terry Turner, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again. In December at your commission meeting, I had sent in my letter of testimony to Tammy to give out to you people. And because of the time limit, I was only able to speak to my concerns about the Nisqually River. So today, since the sturgeon issue is here, I'm going to verbalize my testimony that I wasn't allowed to because of time constraints in December. The sturgeon population in the Columbia River sturgeon is in peril. I fished for sturgeon in the Columbia for 15 consecutive years up to the closure for retention of sturgeon. The number of sublegals hooked and released over that period of time were less and less each year. My concern is that WDF still continues to have a catch-and-release fishery on oversized sturgeon. All oversized sturgeon are female spawners. What is happening on guide boats, charter boats, and private boats is that when a fisherman hooks an oversized sturgeon, he or she fights the fish for a while, then passes the fishing rod off to another fisherman, who fights the fish for a while, who then passes it on to another fisherman until everybody on board boat has an opportunity to fight the fish. So this female spawner is stressed out for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. The fish cannot stand up to that long a time under that kind of stress without damage being done. The result is that it destroys their eggs. They just turn to jelly. A few years ago, National Marine Fisheries Service filmed oversized sturgeon who had 10 or more hooks and leaders coming out of the fish's anus due to the catch-and-release fishery. That means that the hooks and leaders went through the fish's digestive system, obviously causing further damage to the fish. The catch-and-release fishery needs to be eliminated. Until the sturgeon population has recovered and is proven to be improved up to the point of historical abundance. Sturgeon has been overfished both recreationally and commercially for years, and it has caught up with us. All fishing for sturgeon in the Columbia River needs to stop immediately if we are to have any hopes of having sturgeon in the Columbia River in the future. Another issue is the predatory effect the sea lions and cormorants are having on the sturgeon population. I know that the data, I don't know the data for 2011, 12, and 13, but in 2010 at a public meeting, National Marine Fisheries Service reported that sea lions destroyed an estimated 10,000 sturgeon due to the sea lions. Even though they are still on the endangered list, there is no provision in the Mammal Act that can be put into effect to lethally remove sea lions, but it takes action by the Congress to do so. The Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission needs to petition the Congress to act on this. Last comment. The second predator is to sturgeon is cormorants. Rice Island in the Columbia River is a haven for cormorants. WDF has trapped some of these birds, opened them up, and found them to be stuffed with sturgeon fry and smolts besides salmon. Rice Island is a result of past dredging of the Columbia by the U.S. Corps of Engineers. The majority of the cormorant population could be eliminated by dredging out Rice Island and hauling the fill inland. It would make some farmers some rich farm soil. The Fish and Wildlife Commission needs to petition the Corps to dredge out Rice Island.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Robert Sudar, you ready now?
Robert Sudar, commercial buyer. Thank you for giving me a chance to talk again. I want to support a couple of things that Kent and Greg said. I agree with Greg that the cortisol data was not based on a sturgeon study that's at all similar to the way our fishery operates. And also, as Kent said, our Zone 4 and 5 fishery is occurring after the primary spawning season, so I don't think it has a direct correlation in that regard. Some of the other research that was done regarding sturgeon handle was in a 2012 study that's been referenced that was had an early August all-zone fishery. We don't have that fishery anymore since we've had reduction in impacts, and so it isn't realistic in that regard. Over 25% of the sturgeon handle happened in that one-day fishery in early August. Also, there was some the paper itself that this study was based on says that it isn't a zone representative kind of study. They can't estimate handle in any particular zone based on the data they had. And they were actually using a Chinook to steelhead ratio for some of the study. And so I think doing just a straight line interpolation of any sort isn't realistic with the data out of that, and certainly not in applying it to any particular zones. And so I think in general, the fishermen, they aren't looking for oversized sturgeon. Their techniques avoid those at all, if at all possible. There isn't a significant handle in our fishery, and it's occurring at a time when there aren't that many oversized, when there aren't spawning sturgeon in the river anyway. So I think we have a lower impact in that regard than some people might be inferring. Any other questions?
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Well done. Thank you. Nicely done. Okay. Thank you all. That concludes the hearing on this topic. We've reached the end of the agenda for this afternoon, so we will go into recess. What?
Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah, sorry, just, Director sorry. Anderson. Yep.
On the issue of the oversized fishery and at least the. Maybe it was somewhat subtly suggested that we haven't done anything to address that issue. We have done quite a little bit, and one of those is increasing the size of the sanctuary from 6 to 9 miles. And when you look, I'm sorry, I've only got one of these, but you know, when the graphic about the number of oversized fish intercepted and dealt with in this fishery, particularly in the gorge in that spawning area. You go back here into the year 2000, we were talking about something close to 5,000 fish. We're something down, I mean, it's less than 100 now. So there's been a real effort to try to reduce the handling of oversized sturgeon, particularly up in that spawning area. Now, there's some oversized fish encountered in the estuary fishery, as well, and but where we focused our efforts is up in that spawning area. And there's also been, you know, we've had monitors on the any of the gillnet fisheries that have gone on up there, and are the incidental encounters with oversized sturgeon again has been small. So there's been a lot of effort directed toward that. I think the issues that have been brought up and identified in terms of the handling fish and the potential reabsorption of eggs and the other types of things are well placed, but we have taken a pretty dramatic and aggressive approach to trying to reduce those effects.
Thanks for that clarification. Any questions? I think we're ahead of schedule, but okay, we're going to go into recess, commissioners, 7 a.m. We're going to have an executive session here, the room next door. Of course, the executive session will not be open to the public, but following that at 8 a.m., we will convene an open session, and we will make our selection of our next director. So I hope you will come back and stay with us. Thank you. See you tomorrow.